This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Shay Salamone, carpenter, construction manager, workshop leader, and co-founder of the Small House Society, a cooperatively managed and sustained global organization dedicated to the promotion of tiny houses and small housing solutions that are affordable and ecologically responsible. Jay Salamone is here today to tell us about her book, Little House on a Small Planet, published in 2006 by the Lions Press. Welcome, Shay.
It's so nice to be here, Diane.
It's great to have you here. What led you to write your book, Little House on a Small Planet?
Well, I was working as a natural builder and as a workshop leader and as a consultant to people, usually owner-builders, some people who are contracting out their houses. So I was working in the construction industry. And, of course, anyone who works in the construction industry, probably many of your listeners are aware of the enormous amount of destruction that is required for construction. You know, if you've ever just been on a work site after the bulldozers have come in, you notice the kind of eerie silence after it's finished and you're getting ready to build after the, just, you know, the enormous destruction that we use both in clearing the land and then in all the materials that go into the building and then in the long-term costs of running those buildings. So I was working as an ecological builder, and it became a little ironic to me that often the apparently green, apparently so-called sustainable houses were often at the end of a long forest road or a long road into the desert, where it just seemed like, well, we were really encroaching on more and more land. And I really started to question, why are we building this way? I also found out and intuitively kind of had questioned this, that larger houses that are so-called green houses, it's very hard to build a large house that's sustainable. And so even though we were building houses that we called sustainable because of the materials we put into them, because of the technologies we put into them, because they were so large, really compared to small houses or small apartments that are conventionally built, they were often using as much energy or sometimes more energy than those houses, particularly if those houses are located in a city where people are walking in high-density cities such as Manhattan. The real challenge to natural builders, to green builders, is to build houses, build dwellings for people that are as efficient as a city apartment.
What is the significance of your title, The Little House on a Small Planet? Why did you choose that title?
Well, you know, in 1999, I read an article in the Environmental Building News, which is a journal for people working in environmental building, and they had a wonderful segment about, I think it was called Small is Beautiful, about this phenomena that large houses that are so-called greenhouses actually take up more energy than small conventional houses. So I was interested in that, and then I also started to do some research with the Census Bureau, just looking at all these statistics. You know, we have 10.4 million houses that are vacant in the United States. And when we talk about that 10.4 million, that's not just the abandoned houses in the Midwest that no one's paying taxes on or in the Northeast and the Industrial Belt. This is actually houses that typically are luxury houses that are on the market. They're second, third, and fourth homes. They're often very large houses. So we have 10.4 million vacant houses. We only have 250,000 homeless people receiving services. It's an amazing ratio. Now, what does that have to do with the title? The title is a little bit reminiscent of a book that maybe some of your readers have seen called Diet for a Small Planet, which was written by Frances Moore LePay in the 70s. She actually wrote the foreword for my book because she realized that just as she had discovered about food, she had researched food about 25 or 30 years ago and realized that hunger is not really a product of a lack of food in the world. Hunger is a distribution problem. We have plenty of food to feed everyone, but the reason that people are going hungry, it's a little more complex than this, but basically we are not distributing the resources in an equitable way. It's the same thing with housing. People list housing as one of their top concerns. Very difficult. We have a big homeless population, and we also have an underhoused population. We have many people who are struggling to pay their rent or their mortgage. And yet, you would think if we really had a free market system, the cost of housing would be quite low right now since we have an excess of housing on the market, and yet housing appears to be scarce. I know in Seattle, many people have a hard time finding apartments, especially affordable housing. Well, why is that? It's a distribution problem. It's really not a housing crisis when we talk about housing. it's really a sharing crisis that we have. So that's one thing, is it refers to that diet for a small planet. It also refers to that wonderful children's book called Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder, which I think many of us read as children, and which I grew up reading. My great-grandparents and also my grandparents really were homesteaders, and so similar to the stories I'd hear from my father and my grandparents were those stories in those books. And it reflects back to a time in American history when people were living much closer to the land, when the vast majority of people were small landowners, and they were out in rural areas, and they were really sustaining themselves. You know, if we talk about sustainability, there has been a time in American history where, in a certain way, people were doing things in a more sustainable way simply because they were farmers living close to the land. And that was a time that perhaps was not perfect in every way, but that people look back on with a lot of nostalgia. And we know that as a nation, we don't have to be a nation where small groups of people live in huge houses. We also have this history of being a nation of communities and barn raisings and all the wonderful things that went into homesteading, to the positive sides of homesteading.
Focusing on the size of houses, what are the overall trends in house size in the U.S.?
Well, it's interesting that you've asked that. Houses now are over twice the size that they were in 1950. In 1950, they actually were a little bit smaller than they had been previous to that, because in 1950, more and more people were moving into the urban areas, and also the nuclearization of the family was occurring. So prior to 1950, it was actually fairly uncommon for people to live in a house with just one or two generations. So the families were shrinking. In 1950, we had the introduction of tract homes. And these homes were typically somewhere between 900 and 1,200 square feet, and they typically had about four people living in them. Now the average new house is over 2,500 square feet, and it only has about two people living in it. So in a way, we have about four times as much space in our single-family homes as we used to. The trend, it's actually starting to level out a little bit, but it has been towards larger and larger houses, and most recently on smaller and smaller lot sizes. So there's more and more space under roof and less space outside, you know, left over for the birds or plants or landscaping or anything like that.
What is the motivation behind Americans choosing to build larger houses? What reasons do people give for wanting a large house?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, Diane. It's hard for many people to understand other people's desire for huge houses. I started out with this book trying to just create a book for architects and builders who are trying to help their clients figure out how much space they really need and look at other examples. But as we traveled through the country and really talked to people, we found that the desire doesn't necessarily have to do with architectural issues, because a well-designed small house often feels so much more spacious than a poorly designed large house. However, there's some financial and psychological and social reasons why people are moving towards large houses. The first reason I would say that people give, and you know, I think most people will deny this, or many people will deny it, but most people say, well, we're trying to keep up with the Joneses. Everyone wants to have at least as much as their neighbor has. And real estate agents will say, yeah, you just, it's very hard to sell a house on the block if it's the smallest house on the block. No one wants to live in the smallest house on the block. People typically want to live in an average-sized house or a house that's a little bit larger than average. So people typically want to be kind of average. So that's one thing, is that just because house size has increased, everyone, you know, has their whole perspective has increased. So that's one reason why people want larger houses. Another reason is that land is going up in price due to the economic system we have, the way that, you know, land is a speculative financial instrument in our economy. And because of that, as land goes up in price, builders look at that and say, well, if I'm selling houses by the square foot, and that's the unit measurement that we use for houses is square footage, then in order to have the profit margin that I want to have, I need to sell enough house in order to also cover the cost of the land. So either we have to charge more for square foot, or we have to build more house. And many builders have chosen to build a lot more house, because it is hard to convince people to pay more per square foot. And so that's something that needs to shift in people's thinking. Would you really rather have a large house that's poorly built or a smaller house that's maybe much nicer, much more nicely built? So that's one. That's another reason that houses are increasing in size. Another thing over the last 50 years is just the technology has allowed it. it used to just take a lot more labor to build large houses. We have various markets opened up around the world so that we can get inexpensive materials. So those are a few reasons why houses have risen in size.
You've alluded to this already, but could you say more about the resources that are needed to build a house and the environmental impacts of those resources?
Yeah, housing is usually listed. Now, of course, every organization, you know, is going to count it a little bit differently. But housing is usually listed as the second or third most resource-intensive activity that we engage in. Transportation is usually listed as first, and agriculture, of course, is also very resource-intensive. So many of the materials that concern environmentalists quite a bit and concern anyone who is worried about their water supply are materials that go into housing, like copper, for instance. About 40% of all the copper we mine is copper for copper wiring that goes into houses. Every time you build your house a few square feet larger, that means you need a few more feet of copper. And the farther you go out into the wilderness to do that, you need a little bit more copper to bring that electricity down that line. And, of course, building codes have changed so that we have far more outlets, and also the use of appliances has gone way up. So this is just one small example with copper of why we're using more and more copper and how we've gotten to a state where 40% of the copper that's mined is going into construction. So that's just one area. CO2, we often talk with global warming about CO2. Depending, again, on whose statistics you listen to, the use of concrete in construction, cement, Portland cement, of course, requires an enormous amount of energy to be burnt. Cement is a clay product that's created by burning it at a very, very high temperature. So that produces a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere. Some people credit it with 3% of all CO2 in the atmosphere. Some people credit it with 8% of all CO2 in the atmosphere to the production of cement. And, of course, cement, you see it everywhere. Anytime you walk down a sidewalk, anytime you're in a building that has a foundation, you are on top of concrete. It's an extremely common material. Some people say that in our lives it's the material we most come in contact with after water. Now, of course, the long-term energy costs are really significant as well. If you're heating and cooling your house, arguably the long-term heating and cooling costs actually exceed then the short-term costs of construction. And obviously with houses that are poorly insulated, and any house that's large, we have enormous energy costs. And some people say that accounts for about 50% of all of our energy use.
I'm Diane Horn, and we're speaking with Shay Salamon, co-founder of the Small House Society and author of the book Little House on a Small Planet. What is your definition of a small house?
Well, everything's relative, isn't it? So we have in the Small House Society, we don't tell anyone, oh, you can't join, your house isn't small enough. If you are a movie star from North America, 2,000 square feet might be rather small for you. In fact, there are some movie stars who are sort of bragging about how they've scaled down to 1,500 or 2,000 square feet, because in their social group, that's not very much space. There are other people, of course, like the famous Jay Schaefer, who lives in 100 square feet. So I'm not really going to put an amount on the size. I can just say that in the world, it seems like on average, people are really only living in about 150 to 200 square feet per person. So when we see that Americans, on average, are living in more than twice that space, and many, many Americans are living in four times that amount of space, then we know that relative to the average person on Earth, we're living in a lot of space. And that's, you know, that's a philosophical question. Do we believe in equality? If we believe in equality, then we may believe in equality of access to resources. But that's, again, something for each person to look into their soul and really ask themselves, do I really want to be equal with everyone else on Earth? What are my values? What's most important to me?
Your book describes a number of people who have chosen to live in small houses. What reasons did the people give for choosing their small house?
Oh, there's so many reasons. You know, what really inspired me to write this book in a lot of ways is the emotional toll that I saw in people for huge construction projects. We joke as builders about the divorce house, which is a house that you build so that you can get a divorce, because there's so many people who, under the stress of construction or renovation, their lives just fall apart. Or maybe they just get a much bigger mortgage, and that can really damage their whole situation because they're suddenly having to pay so much. So those are two of the main reasons that people move into smaller houses, build smaller houses, or subdivide their house so that they just live in a smaller portion. First of all, for financial reasons, they're saving money, you know, both on the initial cost as well as on the long-term maintenance cost. Another big reason is people are tired of being lonely. We've been talking about the lonely American for at least 50 years, and people are getting tired of being so lonely. Many people have subdivided their house into apartments, which is in Seattle, by the way, is something that's relatively easy to do, relatively allowed, and maybe even at some levels promoted by the city. People who have subdivided their house into apartments are kind of happy to find out that they have neighbors now that they can go over and talk with and have a cup of tea, and you know, they have someone else in their life. So that's really pleasant. Families, some people who have teenagers, ironically choose to move into a smaller house once their kid becomes a teenager because they want to be more involved in the life of that child. We also talk about, you know, houses that help divorces or help families fall apart are often houses that are designed so that people can spend all day in the same house and just not see each other. And that's troubling to some families. They say, we want to be in a house where you kind of, you have to share a bathroom so that you have to see each other. You have to share a telephone so you know what your children are doing. And then, of course, a lot of people in the small house movement, the most vocal people tend to be environmentalists who are aware that it's just not so sustainable to have a lot of personal space, a lot of personal physical space.
What are some examples of small houses you consider especially unique and or creative?
Well, I really like there's stories, you know, in the book there's about 100 different examples. About half of them are really deeply profiled. And the one that I think is most applicable to many, many people in North America, you know, well over a million, probably millions of families in America could do this, is one that in this case is in Eugene, but really could also be in other places, where a family took their 1948 bungalow, 49 bungalow, and they divided off a little studio apartment off of it so that the three of them, instead of living in 1,400 square feet, were then living in about 800 square feet. And then they had this lovely studio apartment. And because they'd done the work themselves, they didn't really increase their mortgage. They were lucky because they had some skills to do this themselves. Because of that, they both really enjoy staying at home. And that's one of the principles in the book, is that we have larger and larger houses, but we have to work so many hours to pay our mortgages that we're not even able to be home and enjoy our houses. So whereas in 1950, you know, at least many, many people were housewives or there were grandparents living in the house, there were people at home enjoying that 1,000-square-foot house. Now we have 2,500 square feet, and it's operating to heat up appliances and maintain the dust in the house, but everyone's out working. So in the case of Eugene, the family, both parents said, we want to be able to stay home. We want to be able to have very part-time jobs. And they divided up their house, and because they're receiving rental income on their house and because they've now managed to pay off their mortgage, they actually have a house that more than pays for itself. So they need to work very little, and they've been able to devote their time to their son and to gardening. They have a huge garden. They were very interested always in being part of a co-housing community, and that never came together for them. And yet they've created that now in their neighborhood because they have extra time. They've been able to go out and create a babysitting cooperative. They have a program where they share work days. They have a system where they exchange work, they barter work, and they barter vegetables, and they have entertainment nights. They have many, many of the aspects of a co-housing community without having to start from scratch. They've just incorporated all their neighbors into this beautiful community. So that's one example. Another thing that many people are doing is something similar where they move out into their backyard into a very tiny dwelling, and they rent out the front part. Jay Schaefer, of course, did that in Iowa City. He's probably the most famous example. I mean, he built just a beautiful little, you know, 100-square-foot, little gabled, kind of Victorian-style, kind of clapboard house. That's just, you know, when you walk into it, you're walking into a little piece of art. That's another very nice thing about small houses, is you can go ahead and spend the money to do things really beautifully because you only have, you know, 100 square feet or 300 or 400 square feet to do it in. You can go ahead and use that bamboo flooring because it's just not, doesn't cost that much. One couple in southern Arizona said that there had been a rodent problem. This was in a rural area, and there was a rodent problem throughout the area, and they were all told that they had to put a certain type of netting up around their house. You know, it only took them about an hour to do it, because they have such a small house. They only live in about 130 square feet. And all over, people, neighbors were complaining that it was taking them weeks and weeks to do that because people had houses that were 10 times the size. So that's another example. Let's see, there are people on houseboats in the book. Right there in Seattle, you have Cecile and Paul Andrews, who, again, used the Seattle accessory dwelling unit ordinance to divide their house into three apartments, and they're very happy about that. They're very happy about the free time that it allows them and the wonderful relationship they have with their neighbors. There's a woman who, after the Oakland fire in Oakland, California, in the Oakland Hills near UC Berkeley, in 1991, there was a terrible fire that burnt down about 5,000 beautiful little arts and crafts bungalows that were smallish bungalows and very nicely done. And they were replaced since it was the early 90s, and that was a time of a lot of greed and a lot of money in the economy. Those houses were replaced often by houses that went lot line to lot line. So they'd be replaced with, 4,000 square foot house, and nothing was left around them. And one woman, an animal rights activist, Polly Strand, she instead decided just to build back. The guest house had not been burnt down on her property, but the main house had. And she said, you know what, I'm not rebuilding the main house. I'm leaving that for the animals. I love animals. I can see that in our neighborhood now there's not going to be any space for the deer. There won't be any space for the raccoons. I'm just going to build up my little guest house on top of my garage, and I'm moving in there. And she did that, and she did such a beautiful job. She said it's not hard to do a beautiful job when you have this huge insurance check and you're scaling down into 600 square feet. But that's quite an inspirational tale. And that's another reason why people decide to live in a lot less space, is because they really care about animals. And the more space that people take up, the less space that animals have to take up. In fact, 2 years ago in the journal Nature, which is a scientific journal, a group of biologists showed that they looked at 150 endangered species that are in particularly difficult, they're having a particularly difficult time keeping their species alive. And in particular, the lead scientist was looking at the panda bear, and he discovered that the main reason that the panda bear continues on a path towards extinction is because the Chinese housing market has become much more like the North American housing market. So even though their population is declining in some areas, their use of resources is going up. And that's because of the suburbanization of China. China is starting to completely mimic North American housing, and houses are far apart. And maybe more importantly, families are splitting up, so the generations are no longer living together. Some people hypothesize that if they hadn't had a one-child policy, but instead had just maintained their traditional way of life, they actually would be using less resources in many areas than they are now. It's a source of debate, but it is an interesting idea that we thought by simply reducing population we could make life more sustainable, and it turns out that that's not always true. If we abandon a more sustainable traditional pattern for a modern pattern, it turns out that three people can use far more resources than the eight people that maybe they would have been there 40 years ago.
What are the special challenges of living in a small house for people that are used to a larger house?
Interesting question. People don't really talk about that. Let's see. Well, one thing people do notice, I'm trying to think, most people just rave about how, I have much more time because I don't have to spend much time maintaining my house. I guess there is something where you do probably have to keep a small house tidier more often. Like the actual amount of time you spend cleaning is not more, but you can't let it go usually as long because you have a natural limit to your stuff. In fact, some people are glad about that. People who've moved into much smaller office spaces often say, I'm much more focused now because I can't have my stuff spreading out all over 200 square feet. It's all in 80 square feet now, and so it's right in front of me. So that's one thing, is you have to learn how to live with your stuff in a different relationship so you have a certain sense of care towards your things. With couples who are not used to living together, and I don't think that this is just in small spaces, it could also be in a large space, they have to learn how to give each other cues that mean I need personal space right now. And I really think that this is an issue in any size house. There's a example in the book, one of the chapters is called Building a Room of Your Own, which is about how most people, almost everyone, need some space, physical space in their life where they can go and it's their own space. It might be just a tiny little alcove or a tiny little office, But most people do want that kind of space to kind of regroup and be part of get back in touch with their soul. And one of the main marketers of teepees in the United States said that who is he selling teepees to now? It used to be hippie families who were moving, back into the woods. Now it is typically suburban women who have large houses. And they say even though they have such a large house, they don't have any space for themselves. They feel like they never have any personal space. Well, because of this, the teepee manufacturers are selling teepees for women who then put them in their backyard. And they say, now I have my personal space. I go out of my 25 or 3,000 square foot house and go into the teepee. But in a small house, if you're very close with someone else and you're both working at home, you have to, determine how are we going to have personal space. So that's a kind of a challenge. I'm trying to think of others. I don't think of a whole lot of challenges. Since I keep scaling down more and more, and it's just not so difficult.
Would you like to say a few words about the Small House Society that you co-founded?
Yeah, it's a sweet organization. It involves primarily a listserv of people who discuss with each other things like goods and zoning, designs, furniture, all types of things that are issues for people living in small houses. That, I would say, actually is one of the biggest barriers for some people, is not actually living in the small house, but being allowed legally to live in a small house. There are many places where the covenants, codes, and restrictions require people to build, 2,000 square feet, or to build an extra garage, or to build all these, extra things that they don't want to build. So that's something that the Small House Society is looking at. How can we support communities like Seattle that have decided that density and smaller houses are really wonderful if we care about sustainability? How can we support those governments in allowing people to live in less space? And what can we do about those areas where people are not being allowed to live their dream, their American dream?
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, this is a sustainability show, right? When I think of sustainability as a question about sustenance, then I can really connect with that word. Because that is the basic question that I think if we ask ourselves as individuals in a sensual world, if we say, hey, what does it really take to sustain me? What things in my life are giving me sustenance? And what things don't feel like they're feeding me at all? When we really ask ourselves that at a very basic and constant level, I think we find that we really just don't need so much space. We don't need to overeat. We don't need, we find this also in diet issues. When people really start getting in touch with what their body really does crave and really doesn't crave, they often find that their diet really does improve. When you really can get in touch with that reality that you have around you, you realize that there's plenty of sustenance for everyone, and that the sustainable way of doing things is to feed the whole world just exactly what it needs and not too much.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Shay.
Thank you, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Shay Solomon, author of the book Little House on a Small Planet, published in 2006 by the Lions Press. For more information, check on the web at www.littlehouseonasmallplanet.com. Again, that's littlehouseonasmallplanet.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.